Support for The Trend comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Today we'll meet the new president of the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana. The regionally focused organization has more than 1,500 members, and according to the chamber, its aim is to create a business, educational, cultural, and government environment that excels in a global marketplace. Christy Gillenwater is in charge of overseeing that vision. She's the new president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana, and she's our guest today. Welcome to The Trend.
Hi, Micah. Great to be here.
So tell me, what does that mean to create an environment that excels in all those areas, education, culture, government, business?
Well, to be a dynamic community and a place that fosters jobs, it's important you excel in all of those areas. So from where we stand, that means engaged public policy to make sure we have state-of-the-art education. We have an environment that supports the ability of our small businesses to continue to grow and provide ample job opportunities for our citizenry here in the region. So all of those things play into it. You know, we have amazing assets here in the region, and I think overall, you know, uplifting our brand and making sure that people here locally and throughout the state and region really understand the dynamics that we find ourselves in here in Southwest Indiana.
What would you say is the brand?
The brand? I think it's underappreciated to what it could be. I think part of it is regional. When I think of our brand or think of particular elements of our region, I think of course, the Ohio River and the valley here we have. I think of obviously our higher educational institutions, which are very dynamic, and we're blessed with those. I think of a lot of great places and things that support, you know, raising a family here in this region. I think we have opportunities to be a more dynamic place for young professionals. But I do think overall that our brand is not as dynamic as it should be based on what we have here.
Dynamic meaning diversified or dynamic?
Dynamic meaning strong, meaning constantly on the form of improvement, momentum, those types of things. I think we're well known for our strong German heritage, for, you know, consistency, which I think is all wonderful. But I think for a lot of young professionals and those who are looking to come to this area, they also want to see progress. You know, I was in a phenomenal meeting talking about our trails and the opportunity for the community to really embrace trail expansion. You know, so we have more bikeable, walkable outlets here in the community, which to me is a real drawing point. And, you know, those types of things to show that we're progressive and we're thinking about, you know, that those quality of place elements that attract people here.
So you spent a number of years from 2005 to 2012. You were the head of the Greater Bloomington Chamber of Commerce, and you got Indiana Chamber of the Year in 2011. What do you think stands out to you from your 7 years there that you can bring to the chamber here in Evansville?
Sure. I think there are similarities to some degree where the organization currently is here at Southwest Indiana, where Bloomington was when I joined the team. And that is that they were ripe for my style, if you will, and how I work within the larger community and within our members and our staff. And so I'm really excited about that. We learned a lot. We learned about transforming our public policy process in Bloomington so that we mattered on the state level, but in particular on the local and regional level, and that we were involved in so many local initiatives and very much so at the table, often one of the first ones called. Those types of things, too. We were very involved in K-12 education and helping to increase the graduation rate. And so we were just seen as a very progressive organization. And that's why we won the state award. We won National Chamber of the Year last year.
You know, you were involved in getting a referendum passed that increased funding for Monroe County Schools.
That's right. We were very involved in that initiative. And yes, that was an operational referendum. And, you know, it's critical, again, the importance of K-12 education. And we as a chamber saw those students are not only, you know, our future workforce, the children of our members and employees, but the future of our community.
Does that mean there's an advocacy role for the chamber? I mean, I know the chamber before you came was involved with the consolidation referendum, which ultimately failed at the polls. But do you see an increased role in terms of public advocacy beyond just working for your members?
I do see more of an opportunity for us to look at our process by which we take positions, but also the engagement level. So, okay, we're going to take a position on, let's say, this IU Med Center, the great opportunity we have for this wonderful medical facility. And, you know, should the chamber take a position on that? And if so, how do we engage in that? You know, do we just say, hey, this is our position, or do we say, okay, let's issue calls to action, let's be, you know, present during these discussions as ideas are evolving? Can we lend expertise via our members into that process? What role do we have to play? And I think that's critical for us moving forward in this community.
Maybe this gets at what you said in an article in the Evansville Business Journal. You were interviewed for that in January, and you talked about leading the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana in a progressive direction. Is that what you're talking about here, or is there more to that?
There's more to that. I also see that as, you know, as I referenced the physical component of the community as well. Again, the trails. You know, how can we play a role in making sure or encouraging businesses to be more worksite wellness friendly? So how are they encouraging wellness? You know, are there opportunities for us to look at how we can encourage businesses to become more green who are members? You know, thinking about the environment. So valuing our community, valuing our people, and coming up with programs or initiatives that help make some of those, you know, implementation options easier for our members. And to me, that's progressive, cutting edge. You know, in Bloomington, I think we were one of the first chambers in the country from our research to initiate a Green Business Bloomington program, which is, again, was encouraging, you know, environmental activities within a place of work that, and, you know, things like recycling or whatnot, and trying to make it easier for a business to implement some of those types of things. So progressive in that kind of form of looking at the community and the region and making sure that our initiatives, you know, align with where the community is trying to go.
How well did that play, that initiative in Bloomington?
I think very well. You know, the healthy business in particular, because that was part of a larger community initiative. And, you know, I look at what the Welborn Baptist Foundation has done here, which is phenomenal work, and celebrating what others are doing, you know, with great recognition for, you know, overall how we can improve the health of our community and the individuals, you know, the lifestyle choices individuals are making. And I think there's a role for multiple organizations in this community to play and those types of large initiatives. I look at the mayor and how he's been up front and really encouraging healthier lifestyle choices. And you know, again, our numbers make a compelling story for why we in the community need to be involved in those types of initiatives.
You have a pretty special opportunity now because you're in that window, and I don't know exactly when it closes, but you're in that window. You've been here for a couple months now, so you have a sense of what's going on. You're meeting people. You know, you have a lay of the land, but you're still new. You still have the perspective of an outsider, and at some point, you'll lose that perspective. What do you think you can do with that perspective for as long as it lasts?
I think, great question, Micah. I think some of it is bringing, you know, a renewed energy to our community, to our community's challenges, but at the same time, the opportunities. And, you know, it's always nice to have someone from the outside come in and sometimes say, you know what, do we realize we really have a lot of great things going here? And have we celebrated those elements lately? And for me, I keep saying the people here, but honestly, it's been overwhelming to me and to our family how wonderful people have been here. And there's just this great sense of, I think, community and community pride. But at the same time, I think we can take that to another level of appreciating our assets here in this region.
We're talking with Christy Gillenwater. She's the new president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana. We'll continue our conversation after a break. This is The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM and WNIN.org. Still to come on the program, we're going to talk tech with Justin Williams in the B segment, and we'll learn how music is used as a therapy tool. That's all trending today on WNIN.
Welcome back to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Our guest is the new president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana, Christy Gillenwater. You've also said that Evansville has real opportunities to shine in the next 5 to 10 years and beyond. What are those opportunities?
Well, I think obviously with I-69, that's obviously a project that the Chamber has been very involved in. And I have the pleasure of filling the shoes of many great men and women who stood before me and pushed for decades for this amazing interstate. But I think that connectivity that I-69 will present for our community, not only throughout Indiana, but through multiple states headed north and south, that's a great opportunity for us to put ourselves on the map, to be one of the, you know, remaining largest MSAs without, you know, that key artery through us. That was a real challenge, I think, for this community. And now that we're connected, I see tremendous logistical opportunities as well as just putting us in the map and the frame, I think, in the minds of others throughout the state and, again, throughout the region. We have a lot of work to do in Kentucky, and as we continue to head north to Indianapolis, although I feel decently confident about that process, and obviously was very involved in that up north in Bloomington.
You were a strong supporter. Yes. While you were in Bloomington.
Absolutely.
Maybe a minority voice there.
Yes, yes. So there are a lot of interesting stories and experiences during those times in Bloomington. But again, great progress has been made for, you know, Section 5, which will be the section that goes from 37, the intersection of I-69 and 37 north to Martinsville. And I think we'll see some good progress here this year on that project as far as, you know, having it move forward, receiving approvals, et cetera. But the big, you know, push now for us is going to not quite shift. It will still continue to be focused on 5 and 6, but the bridge, you know, the importance of the bridge project.
Right, over the Ohio looking south. Because we talk all the time about when are we going to be connected to Indianapolis, forgetting that the road goes the other direction too.
Absolutely. And that is just a critical piece. And that will take a number of years. And I think it's up to those of us in Southwest Indiana, Northern Kentucky in particular, you know, our friends in Henderson, to continue to wave that flag and talk about the imperative, you know, importance that will bring to our region. And other things I will also say is continuing to think about the amazing resource the river is. And from a logistical standpoint, you know, what can we do to help continue to support and provide focus to the river and changes that are needed to be made, et cetera, to keep that as a progressive option for logistical movement here. So those are a couple things. I mentioned earlier the IU Health potential, mm-hmm. I think, for a medical facility here to improve the health of community residents, as well as provide that level of student engagement here in our community, the economic impact, et cetera. That is outstanding. I also think we have tremendous opportunities, in particular in downtown Evansville, but throughout the entire region, to focus on our core of our cities and for more regional collaboration. And that's another nice thing about I-69 is it connects us with other counties, with other partners in this part of the state.
And one of your first moves was to go to speak at the Henderson Chamber.
Yes.
You did that just recently. And there has been, I guess, for some years now, a connection between the some various Warwick County Chamber of Commerce, Gibson County Chamber of Commerce, Henderson, and so forth, with the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana. But what do you see the role of those connections being, and what importance do you place on them?
Absolutely. They're very important. You know, we are technically the Vanderburg and Posey County, you know, Chamber of Commerce, but we have these wonderful relationships throughout the region whereby I think one of the key focal areas is, yes, sharing of information. Another is public policy and making sure that we are advocating for opportunities that collectively in the region we all agree are really important to propel all of us in a forward direction.
You mentioned the I-69 bridge, and that's an interesting point of collaboration because the bridge itself will be completely in Kentucky due to that quirk with how the state line actually is on the north side of the Ohio River. And so there's a major role for Frankfurt to play there, a major role for the Henderson Chamber to play. But the bridge construction costs will be split in some way between NDOT and the Kentucky Department of Transportation. What role does the chamber here, the Southwest Indiana Chamber, have in making this bridge project actually come about?
Well, I think there's a lot we need to do. It's reminding our congressional delegation, you know, the importance of this bridge for economic purposes in the region. It's helping our friends in Kentucky articulate their voice down in Frankfurt. You know, you look at Cincinnati, you look at the Louisville Bridge. I mean, the Cincinnati folks really played a key role in those discussions in Kentucky. And I think, you know, on the Southwest Indiana side of the fence, you know, we need to head down to Frankfurt and to support them in times that are appropriate and articulating our voice. You know, as I-69 is completed, you know, north of the bridge and south of the bridge, it will continue to put more pressure and more bottlenecking will occur on our existing, you know, Highway 41 bridges. And we must all be reminded that the one was built in the 30s, the other in the 60s. These are older bridges. And to put, you know, additional pressure on them, let alone the, you know, stopping that will occur in Henderson and the potential negative impact that can have on their community of, you know, increased flow at the levels that many of us are anticipating once I-69 is complete and that studies have shown, you know, we really need to work now on the bridges so that, you know, the construction isn't delayed farther and farther down the path.
There was a regional economic summit back in 2008 that defined a 26-county economic region in Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois. And it was really sort of more of an east-west, a horizontal space rather than the north-south that one would think of when one looks at a map of Indiana. What's your view of the regional connection here? What are we connected to? How do you define the region economically?
That's a great question. It often depends on who you ask. You know, there are all of these organizations, like, for example, you know, we host our Small Business Development Center. Well, they have a regional footprint. You go to different economic development organizations, they have different footprints as far as what their economic region is considered. So, and, you know, within the state, you know, workforce boards. Mm-hmm. Well, what is our? That is always something I've been entertained by in our state, that the region, that even within state offices, is not always consistent. So to me, you have to have a little bit of give and take. And to your point, you know, tri-state as well. You know, we're a three-state area, so we can't forget about our friends in Illinois and Kentucky. So I think it kind of depends on what you're working on. And I know I'm not giving you a pinpointed answer there. But, you know, again, with I-69, that wasn't there back in 2008 when the study was conducted. So, you know, with the completion of I-69, I think that draws our economic footprint a little bit more north and south than in the past. So to me, moving forward, I think we might need to revisit, you know, what that footprint is. But ultimately, I think there's a lot of similarities in our region. You know, Evansville in many ways is considered, you know, the hub with the airport, et cetera. And just making sure we understand what our assets are in the region and that we play off of those in an appropriate way. And I think that's a great opportunity moving forward. And knowing that a lot of those assets often are in flux, you know, again, and we didn't have Toyota in 2000. Now we have Toyota. You know, that's a wonderful asset. I mean, to have a company of that caliber here in this region is phenomenal. And we have to look at it, although, you know, they're located in Gibson County, the, you know, tax base is there. You know, their employees don't all live there. And so, again, you have multiple states. I'm sure that they have employees from all three states, you know, that have benefited by people purchasing homes, sending their kids to the school system there. And, you know, businesses don't see county lines. And we, I think, as a population hub, need to continue to blur those lines as well.
We mentioned at the top of the show that the chamber has 1,500 members. Obviously, those are your focus, those are your bread and butter, but what's your role beyond your membership?
Obviously, we want to, like you said, tend to those members, but I think also lead on a number of areas. You know, again, public policy, leading on those issues that we see being dynamic, you know, game changers possibly for the community, and sometimes taking, you know, stances that are not popular, but knowing that, hey, it is our belief that these really, you know, this stance is best for our community, and here is why. So I think definitely from the public policy standpoint, that goes beyond, you know, our membership to some degree, although, you know, member engagement and member assistance through that process is really key.
Christy Gillenwater is the new president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce of Southwest Indiana. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
And welcome to Evansville.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer.
And I'm Tony Voss. This week, Justin Williams is back in the B segment for some tech talk. Back in December, we talked about Microsoft's foray into tablets, the new Surface. And since then, Justin's learned a bit more about them.
Yeah, around the Christmas season, we talked about the Surface RT, which was the version of the Microsoft Surface that was basically designed to compete more with the iPad or like an Android tablet in that it was running on an ARM chip, which is kind of the low-powered chip architecture. But it's running a specialized version of Windows called Windows RT, which wasn't really backwards compatible with like traditional Windows software. So if you use something such as like Microsoft Money or the AOL Instant Messenger client for Windows, those weren't actually going to run on the device itself. It was only going to run stuff that came from the Windows App Store. And I played with the Surface RT, and I really liked it. And like my experience was, I walked into one of those Microsoft stores that they had set up in Times Square just to basically sell services and Windows phones. And I went and I stood by one and I started playing around and just swiping around and tapping on things on that start screen. And it was a really cool experience. And I liked the little touch-based keyboard. And I was all in. And I was like, this is actually pretty cool. I'm impressed. I like the hardware. The hardware feels nice. The start screen stuff is responsive. There's some pretty cool apps on here from like ESPN and NBC. And I'm really into it. And then I accidentally hit the Microsoft Word button. And it took me to a traditional Windows desktop with like running the traditional version of Microsoft Word. And I was just like, oh, it completely took me out of the experience. It didn't feel like I was using a next generation tablet anymore. It felt like I should be using a desktop PC. And that was kind of frustrating. So the Surface Pro, which is the more powerful full version of the Surface, came out towards the end of January. And the difference between it and the RT is it's a little bit thicker. It's got worse battery life because it's running an actual Intel chip inside of it. But it does run the full-on version of Windows 8 that you can get on any desktop PC or laptop, which means it will run any software that'll run on Windows. So is it a better device than the Windows RT? I guess it depends on what you want to do. If you need to run traditional Windows software, yes, it's a better device. If you want better battery life, no, it's not. Windows 8 is something that's designed to run on a laptop with a touchscreen, not a tablet with a keyboard cover. So something like a Dell laptop that has like the touchscreen, that feels really great with Windows 8 because the start screen is something that is tailored towards touch, but that's where Microsoft needs to go next. They need to build some sort of tablet that supports this touch-based input. I don't think building an iPad competitor like the Surface is necessarily going to net them a lot of sales, at least not yet.
Recently, Mike Krahulik of Penny Arcade, who is an artist, posted a review of the Surface Pro, and he made mention of how good it is as a drawing system because he could use a stylus with it, whereas with the iPad, you can't.
That's going to be really ironic if the Surface or these Microsoft-based tablets become the de facto for artists because it supports things like a stylus. Because as much as Apple likes to tout it, and as much as I do believe that like a finger is perfect for 95% of what you want to do with dealing with these touch-based devices, there are certain situations where a stylus does make sense. And drawing or taking handwritten notes is definitely one of those. So I think it would be in Apple's best interest to add some sort of like system-level support for different types of styli. I think it's styli. But at the same time, I don't think they're going to do it because I think they're so ingrained in the finger-based input that it's not in their best interest right now to support those unless they build the Apple stylus. And I can't see them doing that at this point.
Well, let's move now from something we've actually seen to something no one got to see. The Sony PlayStation 4 was announced last week, but never shown in an interminably long presentation.
The PlayStation 4 announcement was really odd in that they built up this giant press event, and everyone knew this was going to be the PlayStation 4. All of the gadget sites like Engadget, Gizmodo, The Verge, all these sites went there to see the new PlayStation, and they heard a lot about the new PlayStation, but they didn't actually see the physical hardware, which was really weird. They didn't really get much more than seeing what the input is in terms of the new DualShock 4 controller, which looks exactly like the old PlayStation controller, except it's got a touchscreen in the middle of it and a share button. That was about the highlight of the event for me. Otherwise, it was a couple demos of games that might be coming out sometime for the PlayStation and a lot of talk about hardware. So in terms of the hardware itself, what we know inside of the device is it's basically a really souped up PC. It's running an x86 chip, I think being made by AMD. It's going to have 8 gigs of RAM, which is pretty impressive for something that's going to sit in front of your TV. And it's going to have a pretty high horsepower GPU to run all the graphics and push all the pixels for this thing. But in terms of what the physical PlayStation 4 looks like, they didn't really show anything or say anything about that. That's to be seen.
Not to get too nerdy, but while a lot of gamers and fans probably hated the presentation, there were probably quite a few developers breathing sighs of relief over the PS4's architecture being more PC-like than the PS3 was.
You basically had to learn a completely new, completely difficult foreign language to build stuff for this thing. Whereas when you're building stuff for the Xbox, it's like building for a PC. So if you know how to build PC games, it's a lot easier to port to those. It's a lot easier to build for it because you've got this like built-in domain knowledge for it. Basically, what PlayStation is doing now is they're saying, all right, we're going to give you the PC hardware. So if you have to get to this low-level hardware stuff, which game developers do because they need to eke out as much horsepower as they can, it's going to be a lot easier because you're used to speaking in this x86 language.
And then I guess for people who really, really, really want to see the black slab that will be the PlayStation 4, we're probably now pushed ahead to something like E3.
Yeah, I think E3 is going to be the big unveil for both Microsoft and Sony going forward. I think this event was basically Sony wanting to get out there first with something. They obviously held back a lot of cards for E3, which is coming up in June. And that's when we're probably going to see the hardware for both. We're going to see a lot of the games that are going to be coming out at launch. And then that's when we can start making the decisions about which ones we're going to buy.
Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. Video game. It's you, it's you.
Justin Williams is our tech expert at WNIN, and his columns regularly appear on Thursdays in the Courier and Press. I'm Tony Voss.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We all know music can affect our mood, trigger memories, or make us want to move. In very simple terms, that's the basis for the field of music therapy. And today we'll explore this fascinating and sometimes misunderstood field. And March is Music Therapy Awareness Month in Indiana, so our guests are two music therapists. Casey DePriest is the founder and owner of Integrative Music Therapy in Evansville. She's also a member of the executive board of the Association of Indiana Music Therapy and serves as chair of the Indiana Music Therapy Task Force. And welcome to The Trend.
Thank you, Micah.
Eric Lund is also here. He works as a music therapist at Integrative Music Therapy. Welcome.
Thank you, Micah.
Casey, why don't you start us out with just the basic definition? You're on an elevator and somebody says, what do you do? And you say, I'm a music therapist. And they say, what's that?
Okay, I get that question a lot. Music therapy is the use of music and music strategies to help individuals address non-musical goals. We serve a variety of different need areas. And just like other types of therapies, our therapy is very goal-directed. So we work with people who have difficulties with social and emotional issues, speech, language, and communication, sensory motor deficits, as well as cognitive deficits. And so we use music strategies to help them improve in those areas.
So how does music do that?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, music can be very motivational. So Sometimes we use music to motivate someone to work on things that are otherwise really difficult for them. Sometimes we use
music. Is that like using music in a gym to like get you moving? I mean, is it the same concept?
It's the same concept. It's just the techniques that we use are very much based on research and are very specific to the assessment that's been done of that particular client or patient and their specific needs. So rather than just being a general use for a whole class of people, it would be specific to a client's needs. And then we also sometimes use rhythm and music to help a person structure movement or to structure their cognitive processes so that they can be more successful in moving, communicating, developing speech or communication skills. Music is a whole brain activity. And so whereas speech just has one speech center in the brain that kind of lights up when a person is speaking, when someone's involved in music, there are multiple areas of the brain that actually light up or engage. And so through music, we can sometimes develop new neural pathways that allow people to be successful in areas when maybe they're not already.
What does that mean, involved in music? Does that mean you have to be playing or can you just be listening?
Typically, music therapy is a very active music-making process. There are various different techniques that we use, but oftentimes in our work with clients, we are doing active music-making. We do some music listening for specific purposes, but oftentimes we get the client, actively moving, playing instruments, actively singing, actively engaging in the music process.
Eric Lund, you've got a guitar on your lap here, and we're going to hear that at some point. Do you use that instrument a lot in your music therapy sessions?
Yeah, and certainly am not limited to the guitar. I do use it often, but everything that you use has to have a direct purpose for why you're using it. So I'm not just going to bring the guitar so I can sing at a client or sing at somebody. It's much more of a cooperative process, much like a physical therapist will work with somebody to work on rehabilitative needs. I will use the guitar with a client to work on improving their speech, their enunciation, or to work with social engagement. Different goals that it would be appropriate for. And I'm not limited to the guitar also. One nice thing about my education and being a music therapist is that you have to be, adept at many different styles of making music, of different instruments and whatnot. So I do play a variety of different instruments, and I use different types of music to help facilitate different needs and different goals. So, for instance, let me give you an example. If I'm going to be working with the client on speaking a little more clear with better enunciation, somebody who may have some oral motor issues, they're not able to move their tongue, move their lips, or have paralysis on half of their face, so they can't use that side of the face very much. I'm going to use just singing in general to work on improving that oral motor skill. And maybe once that is set up, then I will start singing with a guitar to sort of complete that exercise. So that they, get to have the basis of it, which is singing, and then they can sort of wrap it up with a whole sort of experience of music with an instrument and with another person singing with them. And so it depends on how you use different instruments. But
so, Casey DePriest, if you have someone who is suffering from a condition like Eric's describing here, and you're using singing, what does singing do, music do, that doing speech or some other kind of physical exercise wouldn't do?
Well, like I mentioned before, music speaks to a different part of the brain sometimes than speech. Oftentimes, people who have suffered a stroke may have difficulty with speech. They may have lost their ability to speak, but they may not have lost their ability to sing. And I don't know if you've heard much about Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, but she's a great example of how music and song was used to help rehabilitate her speech, because her brain was damaged by the gunshot wound, but through music and through some specialized music therapy techniques, her brain was able to adapt and actually kind of circumvent itself and develop new neural pathways
around the damaged area that still allowed her to develop successful speech.
March is Music Therapy Awareness Month in Indiana, so we're discussing music therapy with two music therapists, Casey DePriest and Eric Lund, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN-FM and online at WNIN.org.
Support for WNIN comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we're discovering the field of music therapy with Casey DePriest and Eric Lund. They're both from Integrative Music Therapy. And Casey is the founder and owner of that business. You're working in private practice, so that's one example of where music therapists work. But where do music therapists also get employed?
That's a great question. Music therapists really work in a wide variety of facilities and with a wide variety of populations. For instance, there are music therapists that work in public education in schools. There are music therapists that work in hospitals with med-surg units, with pediatric oncology, with the neonatal intensive care. There are music therapists that work in skilled nursing or long-term settings like nursing homes or rehabilitation centers. There are music therapists that work in hospice. And, you know, we specialize at our practice, we specialize in individuals with developmental disabilities, and we do serve individuals on a community basis within the community and within our clinic. But there are also music therapists that serve that population that may work in day programs for adults. They may work in developmental preschools for children, just a wide variety of really exciting job opportunities for music therapists.
Eric, you, and this is the case for Casey as well, but you knew going into college you wanted to be a music therapist, and you studied, which is why you have a guitar with you, studied classical guitar. That is your main instrument, but why music therapy?
I got to see parts of it firsthand when I was young and volunteering in a nursing home, and I learned how to play a guitar, and I brought it in for individuals with Alzheimer's, and I would play, and I would, you know, sort of see a difference and see how exciting it was that everybody would sing along when they didn't know how to speak or remember the songs really in particular, but they knew how to sing them. And I was amazed by that, and I figured this would be a wonderful thing to do. And so I looked into it and came down here to the University of Evansville and stayed around.
So that's a very different feedback that you get as a, I say, performer in a very loose sense here as a music therapist, but it's a very different type of feedback than if you were, say, playing a concert to an audience.
Yes, with some of the individuals with Alzheimer's that I was working with when I was young and learning how to play guitar, the staff would be happiest if the ones that were really high anxiety fell asleep while I was playing. Yes, a much different audience. Obviously, I don't encourage that now.
No standing ovation.
Laying down ovation, yes.
I see. And what about you, Casey? I mean, this is something that you studied in college, too. Mm-hmm. And it's a course of study that's interesting because you're doing a lot of the same kind of work that a music major would do, but then you're also doing various cognitive science work and mm-hmm. psychology work and blending it all together.
Right. And that's really what I loved about the program at the University of Evansville and the music therapy training in general is that, you know, I think music and your love of music is what brings you to the field. But then you get to explore so many other different areas that enhance you as a professional, but also help you learn how to reach so many different populations and so many different people. You know, everybody can relate to music on some level. And so it's kind of, you hear about it being the universal language. Music is the universal language in itself. But through the training that we receive, we can then help people who have mental health issues. We can help people that have physical rehabilitation kinds of issues. We can help people that have, learning difficulties because of the types of training that we have. But through all of that, we are learning our instrument, we're learning about, music and becoming a better musician, but we're also learning about
the impact that music has on the brain, and the different responses that music can bring about, as well as really delving into the research that is behind our profession.
Yeah. Casey hits at a really important part there, which is when I was young and idealistic about music and it making an impact, I really didn't understand what it did. But once you get an education, you get to start working with different populations, you get to see how the evidence and the evidence-based practice really is what makes the difference, and not just music itself, is understanding how it works. And that's what's really wonderful, and why music therapy is making an increased impact, is because it is an evidence-based practice.
And there is a lot of misunderstanding about that, and I guess this desire for you to have people understand that this is an evidence-based and it's as scientific as physical therapy is, mm-hmm. or some other discipline like that. That has in part led to House Bill 1051, which seeks for additional recognitions for music therapy. So what does House Bill 1051 do that's not already in place?
All music therapists who complete their at least a bachelor's degree education and extensive clinical training, including a 6-month internship post-graduation, and then pass their board exam, their national board exam, are then considered board certified music therapists. And that is a national certification. So what House Bill 1051 is intended to do is to help recognize that credential and to help define what music therapy is in Indiana, to make Indiana as a state specifically recognizing and understanding those of us who work as music therapists within the state, and to protect our practice and our credential within the state.
So what's the problem right now? Are people who are not music therapists trying to pass themselves off as such?
As you mentioned before, there's some misunderstanding. I think people in general know that music is powerful. I think people use music in their own lives. And so sometimes there's an assumption that, if I can play the guitar, or I can play the piano, and I go into a nursing home and people respond to me that I'm a music therapist or I'm providing music therapy. And again, as Eric mentioned, it's really important that people understand that those of us who practice music therapy do so as an evidence-based practice, and we're doing the techniques that we're doing based on research, not just based on a whim or based on our interest in making people happy through music. And all of those things are great, and we are in no way saying that people cannot use music. We're just saying they can't call it music therapy if they don't have the appropriate training. And so that's really what it's about. It's not necessarily to point fingers at anybody who's doing anything wrong. It's just basically to protect those of us who are, and just to help the public understand what music therapy is. It helps employers know if they're interested in music therapists, what they need to look for as far as a credential when they're hiring.
And as we tape this interview in mid-February, the House has passed that bill, and now we are waiting for the Senate to take action on that bill as well. And you've got a Hill Day coming up on the 5th of March.
That's correct, yes. Indiana music therapists will be gathering together at the State House on March 5th to thank the legislators who have supported our bill, and to hopefully make contact with those senators who will be voting on our bill in the days to come, and be there as a resource to answer any questions that they may have, and just to be a presence in Indiana, because we're very proud of who we are and what we do, and the work that we do with the clients that we serve.
Well, we have a couple minutes remaining, and I know you've brought along some actual music therapy, what would you call these, techniques or?
Yeah, a couple of different methods that we use within our work. One of them is we were going to demonstrate for you one of our social rhythm songs. Social Rhythms is a program that we developed at Integrative Music Therapy to help individuals with developmental disabilities improve their social skills. And so, Eric, if you want to help us out here, we'll sing through a little bit of this, and you can kind of get a sense of what this song may do to help individuals learn about social skills.
This is Social Rhythms, welcome to the group. This is Social Rhythms, where you can join our groove. This is Social Rhythms, where you can be a friend. This is Social Rhythms, we'll party till the end. Practice being a friend, show them that you really care. you meet somebody, you look them in the eye. Look up at their forehead if you feel really shy. When you meet somebody, you listen and you share. First you ask a question, then listening shows you care. Practice being a friend, show them that you really care.
So why can't you just tell someone that?
It sinks in.
Well,
and it helps them.
Micah, how did you learn the alphabet?
Right, yeah. Right.
It's very much the same sort of thing.
Yeah. It sticks with you because you have for some reason you can remember a melody better than you can remember just a string of letters or a series of words.
Exactly.
So again, different areas of your brain are engaging when you're singing the alphabet song.
Interesting.
Or the social rhythms groove. And it helps to structure the learning to help them learn those steps of social engagement.
And I see what you're trying to do here, but I'm not going to sing it. Okay, we've got time for you to do one more exercise here. And this is a songwriting exercise you do with folks. And explain what this is.
Well, in this case, we take a song that's already been written by somebody else. We cut out certain words and then let the person fill in certain words to help process an emotion or process an event or a situation.
Mm-hmm. This is used a lot for self-expression. What we find is that individuals sometimes have a very difficult time talking about what's going on with them. But if they engage within a music process and music therapy, they kind of let their guard down a little bit. And music therapy can create a pretty non-threatening environment for someone to do something that might be difficult for them. And so it might be difficult for someone to share about what's going on in their life. But if we put it to song, it's a lot more fun and it can be motivational for someone to just kind of share what they need to talk about. So would you like to be a guinea pig here?
Okay, I'll try this out.
All right. So we're going to do the song Bye Bye Love by the Everly Brothers. And we're just going to work on the chorus. And so, Micah, I'd like you to think of a couple of things that you'd like to say goodbye to.
Well, I'm sure I'm not alone in wanting to say goodbye to my mortgage payment.
Okay, perfect.
How about that?
All right. So we're going to say bye-bye mortgage. Bye-bye. Can you put that in a couple other words? What else would you say?
Bye-bye house payment.
Okay.
All right, we're going to write this in.
Yeah, we'll write this down. So
this is songwriting happening right now.
And bye-bye house payment.
Okay.
Okay. And then what could you say hello to in your life if you could say bye to those two things?
Let's see. How about hello independent wealth?
I like it.
This is very ambitious.
Yes. All right. And then how would that change your life? If you said hello to independent life, you could think about yourself or you could feel what?
I think I'll fly around the world.
Ooh.
That is ambitious.
In an airplane, Eric. I'm not wearing a cape here.
Okay. So we'll just do one verse or one part of that. We might at some point do two. We may just repeat it. And then at the end, we'll say bye-bye. Mortgage, bye-bye house payment.
Okay.
You have to sing along, okay?
Oh, my. I'm going to back away from the microphone here. I like to talk on the radio, not sing.
All right. One of the great things about music therapy is you really don't have to be musical to benefit from music therapy. And that's another misconception. Like, oh, well, I can possibly, because I can't sing. Or you really have to have absolutely no musical ability in order to participate in music therapy and benefit. So it's pretty cool. Easily accessed.
Ready?
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye mortgage.
I can agree.
Bye-bye house payment. Hello, independent wealth. I think I'll fly around the world.
Sing it again.
Bye-bye mortgage.
I'll get closer to the mic.
Bye-bye house payment.
There you go.
Hello, independent wealth. I think I'll fly around the world.
Bye-bye
mortgage, bye-bye. Bye-bye house payment, bye-bye.
How do
you
feel?
If only it were that easy.
That's right. But you can imagine some of the things that we might be able to process with the client, just through that simple process of really getting them to, think about, first of all, what can they control? Mm-hmm. What can they not control? So we can help somebody, really think through the process of what can I change? What can I do? How would that make me feel better? Which in turn would probably motivate them to make some changes in their life. So just a quick example of a songwriting intervention.
Well, thanks so much for sharing the work that you do and helping us to understand the wide world of music therapy. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate the opportunity to share with you today, Micah.
Casey DePriest is the owner of Integrative Music Therapy. She's also a member of the executive board of the Association of Indiana Music Therapy, and she serves as a chair of the Indiana Music Therapy Task Force. And Eric Lund is a music therapist as well at Integrative Music Therapy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN-FM and online at WNIN.org.
Support for WNIN comes from The Lang Company, authorized dealer for Konica Minolta office equipment, supplying Konica Minolta color and black and white digital office systems. More product information at 426-1496.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and I'm joined now by Roger McBain for our weekly Arts Notebook. Hi, Roger.
Good afternoon.
And Roger, I like it when our conversation is thematic, and today we're talking about what might be termed intimate art.
I will start off with Mardi Bras, or Mardi Bras. I'm not sure how they pronounce it. There's an S on the end of that. It's an annual fundraiser-style show and auction for the AIDS Resource Group of Evansville. This is the fourth year. 17 artists have done 24 bras and bustiers to be modeled in a runway show today at Casino Aztar, 7 to 11 p.m. today, to raise money for the AIDS Resource Group.
And the other intimate arts event is this annual staging of Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues at the University of Southern Indiana.
Seventh year that they have done that there. And, you know, these are the monologues that are based on interviews with hundreds of women, basically addressing the female condition of from relationships to discrimination to sexuality. They are doing that at the University of Southern Indiana, 7 p.m. today, $7. Money from that will go to a women's advocacy group and support group in Posey County, and then to the national and international V-Day operations that Eve Ensler supports.
Okay, we have some musical events to tick through, and the first one involves a pun, as bad as I hope the music is good.
Yeah, Kitty Savia, violinist here, came up with the title Box Lunch for a program of music that includes music by Bach, and it's at lunch with a packaged meal or a box lunch. Monthly concerts at St. John's East United Church of Christ with Sarah Moon, their organist and music director, performing with various other people. Starts Wednesday. It's going to be every month.
One of your articles this week was quite shocking to me. It begins with the ominous words, Evansville pipe organists are back to their old tricks. And I guess this has to do with corrupting pianists.
Right. Kitty Savia would probably call this an organic pizza party. It's called Pedals, Pipes, and Pizza. And it's something put on by the American Guild of Organists local chapter every year to lure young people in to get them to play the organ, to try it out. It's going to be March 9th at University of Evansville's Wheeler Concert Hall. They want pianists 10 years and older to come, and I think it's $10, includes pizza and a lesson on the pipe organ there. And then on the 15th, they're doing one, they're calling it Pedals, Pipes, and Tacos for adult keyboardists, and that's going to be at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. That one's free, and they go out for Mexican food afterward.
And finally, an upcoming event where the organ is joined by choral voices.
Musicians from Indiana University are going to perform sacred and choral and organ music at 3 p.m. March 9th at St. Meinrad Arch Abbey in St. Meinrad, Indiana, and that is free and open to the public.
That's the Arts Notebook with Roger McBain, and you can find all his articles in the Courier and Press and at courierpress.com. Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.